Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to Let's Talk, a show that's all about bringing you the best and most important conversations of the day. I'm at the Georgetown Literary Festival in Penang. This is the handbook, the theme of which, the state of freedom, because a very important topic for many of us who have enjoyed and celebrated the political breakthrough we had on May 9th. Now with me is festival director and curator, Bernice Chorley. Bernice, thank you again for joining me on the show. Why the state of freedom? Why was that so important to kind of put that there, put it out there, as it were, for, as a theme for the festival?
Well, the theme was actually decided last year, before GE14, and it was already sort of approved by the chief minister then, Lim Guan Eng, and it was sort of, you know, it could have been, could have gone either way, but it fell in our favor. So it just resonates more and more with us Malaysians, but it also looks at the states of freedom that we as writers work, live, and struggle in.
Right. You know, in some ways, the Georgetown Literary Festival, which I've been involved in from its very inception, was kind of oasis of freedom in the country, especially as it, you know, the space for speaking up and speaking critically kind of diminished over the years. It's interesting that it's now culminated in a time.
Yeah.
But are there things that we still find difficult to talk about in this country? I mean, Bernice, you're a writer, you're a published writer. Do you think there's still a lot of lines, invisible lines, that prevent us from being free?
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. You know, one of the things that we're going to be talking about, one of the many things that we're going to be talking about in the festival is looking at the issues of race. There's a panel called Susah Jadi Melayu, which is going to be very interesting. We are also looking at questions that are posed to the LGBT community in Malaysia and outside Malaysia. We have so these are sort of, you know, very sensitive topics. But as the GTLF has been known as sort of, you know, the last bastion of free speech in Malaysia, we are really pushing the boundaries of conversation even more.
Okay, and I think that pushing the boundaries thing is very important. And it's also interesting that it's a very cosmopolitan group of people, right? Mm-hmm. So you have a French doctor and a novelist, Jean-Christophe Ruffin, and any number of other, you know, writers and journalists from India and so on and so forth from the region. The cosmopolitan nature of the festival and the cosmopolitan nature of Georgetown's own history, it's a wonderful mix.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I'm wondering, how much more can it be on that score?
Well, you see, I mean, I've looked at it from, you know, from the very beginning. We started the festival with history, what are our stories, you know? So looking at Georgetown as a historical sort of confluence and port of conduit, a crossroads for so many different cultures and traditions over the last few hundred years. And then we looked at the ties it binds. So I think the themes of the festival have slowly evolved to become braver and more courageous. And I see the number 8 as sort of like the octave. We've come from, you know, looking at our history and now looking at the state of freedom. Not necessarily just you know, Penang as it you know, being known as the bastion of free speech, thanks to Lim Guan Eng, but also looking at what are the boundaries of freedom? What are the dangers of freedom? You know, we have a panel on hate speech. That can also be seen as a sense of freedom. You know, I am entitled to speak about a particular person or about a particular group of people. So these are things that we're looking at from both sides. And we're creating, a very expansive, cosmopolitan discourse with 100 participants from 25 different countries this year.
100? I remember 100. The days when you could count the number
yes.
of people on your hands,
yes.
right?
Yes.
Because they have, and it always happens over in festivals over the years, people drop out. We had, of course, somebody I really wanted to have a conversation with, Asli Erdogan,
yes.
Turkish writer. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about her. I know she's not going to be here.
Yes,
but
yeah.
Why, and who is she, and why she was she so important to the festival?
Well, Asli Erdogan is a Turkish dissident writer who was imprisoned after the coup, the unsuccessful coup that happened in Turkey 2 years ago. She was treated very badly in prison, and as a result of that, her health has suffered greatly. She's now a German citizen, and a few days ago, she was receiving the highest award for freedom in Oslo for her work as a novelist, as a journalist, someone who has written about the unsayable, you know, in Turkey, which is the Kurdish issue. And she developed a very bad infection, and she could barely walk off the stage. So as a result, she is completely unable to fly. And we're very, very disappointed because she was one of our headlining writers this year.
Okay, there are also tributes and awards at this festival. Feku, the late Feku, I think is going to be honored at the festival as well.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, Feku was a very dear friend of mine. And, you know, she was a food critic and a food writer and from Penang, of course. We started Rhino Press together, if you remember, in 1997. And she died very, very suddenly and very tragically of cancer last year. So Bettina Chua Abdullah, one of her dear friends, decided to create this award in tribute to her, an award for food and drink writing.
And because freedom to eat is, I think, one of the guiding principles of the lives of most Malaysians, right?
Well, especially in Penang, you know, which is one of the food capitals of the world.
It is indeed, and I wouldn't dispute that.
Yes, I would take... I was born here, so, you know.
So you're partisan in that regard.
Yes.
What else is going in the mix, especially for young people who perhaps are not so familiar with literature? Is there kind of an outreach dimension to the festival?
Well, this year, for the very first time, we're hosting the first National Poetry Slam. And this was a call out to the whole country. We received many, many, I think more than 57 entries. And we have 12 finalists, two of whom are from Penang,
right,
age 16 and 17. So hopefully by the end, well, we will, by tomorrow night, we will have a slam champion who will represent Malaysia at the World Cup.
You know, what's interesting to me is that there's always this criticism. It's trotted out far too easily about young people, post-literate, you know, only interested in their mobile devices and never reading. And yet we see this interest in poetry and an old form of expression.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What's your sense? I mean, you're a teacher as well.
Yes.
I mean, are young people, have they forgotten the book and the novel, and are they re-embracing it?
I think poetry has been, you know, it's always been a form of expression. It's one of the oldest forms of human expression. Every culture in the world has some form of poetry, whether it's in song or prayer or some sort of incantation. There is a huge interest in poetry because poetry has evolved over the centuries, over the years, and now because of Instagram and social media, there are Insta poets who have become very, very famous.
And Insta poets?
Insta poets, yes. People like Rupi Kaur and Lang Lee. Have you not heard of them?
No, I haven't.
Well,
okay. I'm not on Instagram. Well, I am, technically. But,
but quite a few young Malaysian poets are very, very famous on Instagram. But the form has evolved, and spoken word is very, very popular, as you know, in Kuala Lumpur. And, you know, there are packed out gigs. There are, I think, 5 or 6 different events that happen on a monthly, weekly basis in KL alone. And, you know, because I teach poetry, and the form has changed, but the interest is always there. And, you know, this year I'm teaching a wonderful group of students who are very, very familiar with the form and with rhythm and metrics and structure and metaphor and things like that. So, and, you know, some of them are really, really good. They're really, really, seriously, very, very,
very good.
This is the next generation of poets in Malaysia.
Well, I'm glad for that. You know, there's always this other thing about festivals. They often have big, you know, the headliners, the stars, you know, the people who probably travel here business class. But Georgetown is quite different that way.
Yes.
I mean, it's always had very interesting people, but not necessarily the big, big stars.
Mm-hmm.
This year, is it any different, or do you have some big stars?
Well, we do have Jean-Christophe Ruffin. We've got some really big names from India. We've got Jeet Thayil, who was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. We've got Tishani Doshi. We've got some really big Malaysian names as well. Because we have a very small budget, and we work with the embassies. So it's the embassies that support the writers who come to the festival. And, you know, we pay everyone the same amount. Everyone gets, you know, nobody's treated differently. You get the same kind of room. We can't afford business class. So if they are, you know, so inclined, then they're just going to have to pay for it themselves.
Is it a saving grace for this festival not to have too much money? Because sometimes money can spoil you and it can change the dynamics.
Yeah.
Is there a chance that Georgetown will grow into something different from what you originally thought of it ought to be?
You mean the festival? Or
the festival, the Georgetown Festival, Literary Festival, and in its scale. Because there was something very human about the scale, and remains so, even though you have now quite a number of writers from so many countries.
Yeah, we've hit we've hit three digits, and that's kind of extraordinary.
I think is it too big?
I think this is the maximum we'll ever go. This is the maximum that we have to cap it at this, because, you know, it's just unwieldy. It becomes unwieldy.
I mean, the Jaipur Literary Festival is here. I mean, it's mammoth, right?
Yeah. It's a tamasha.
Yeah, it's a tamasha. It's hundreds of thousands of people. Yeah. You know, and it might be very interesting on one level, but it does become much more of a spectator sport than something that's intimate and where you can engage and you feel you're rubbing shoulders with precisely the people you listen to.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, because we are in Georgetown, it is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. I mean, the scale of Georgetown matches the scale of the festival. And that's why I think it can't get any bigger than this. And we have very intimate spaces. I mean, you know, the building that we're in is a beautifully restored heritage building. We use multiple venues around Georgetown, all within walking distance. And the intimacy has always been there. I don't think, you know, we've had a difference between 5 writers and 100 writers at that scale, because we keep it intimate. And we invite writers who are willing to engage with their audiences, and, you know, who are willing to spend time talking to them, you know, taking questions that might be a little bit offbeat or a little bit quirky or a little bit seditious or provocative, because we push the writers as well to talk about things that they may not feel comfortable talking about.
Now, the festival, because not everybody could come here and for all kinds of reasons, does the festival exist on other platforms? Will it outlive, I mean, once the circus moves on, will it be there, you know, social media? Are you putting out podcasts? How does the festival continue beyond its actual duration?
Yeah. We have a YouTube channel.
YouTube channel?
Yes, we do have a YouTube, a designated GTLF YouTube channel. We have updates every day, so, you know, things are sort of uploaded all the time on social media, on Instagram and on the YouTube channel as well. You know, we don't have the funding for podcasts because it's just a lot of money that we don't have, but the recordings, I think, will survive the time. And, you know, it's because it's written about by so many people from all over the world. You know, we have writers from the Netherlands, from Germany, from Indonesia, and from Singapore. So the festival will live on in the sense that it will be talked about and it will be loved and appreciated and respected by many, many people for years to come.
Bernice, I know this is your last year. You've chosen to end your relationship as the director of the festival. Yeah. What's your hope for the festival going forward? What do you think it really needs to remember as it continues its life?
I think, you know, I've tried to create a certain kind of legacy, and it's I suppose, my parting gift to the people of Penang and to Malaysia, but I think the integrity of the festival has to remain. The fact that we really still engage with issues that provoke us, that inform us as writers, thinkers, and members of the human race, really. You know, and I think a festival like this is kind of like a mental workout. It's good for you. It's good for you. It makes you think. It makes you laugh. It makes you sort of slightly weepy, and it pushes you to the boundaries of what it means to be human, really. And those conversations that we've had for the last 8 years have reflected that. That need.
Right. Thank you so much, Bernice.
Thank you.
I'm going to be speaking next to Cam Razlan and Joe Kukathas. Stay tuned to Let's Talk with Misha Radkutan. Hi, and welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutan. I'm here at the Georgetown Literary Festival. My next guests are Cam Razlan and Joe Kukathas. Joe, Cam, thank you so much for joining me. Cam, you've been at the festival for the longest time, since its inception almost. What do you think the Georgetown Festival brings to the literary community of Malaysia, yourself being an author?
It brings an opportunity for... Writing is a very lonely experience. Mm. And so here's an opportunity for writers to come together, but also with publishers, with... people who run other festivals around the globe, actually. Bernice Chorley has done that. There's somebody from the Mekong Review, which is a wonderful literary review. So you get to meet people outside of the lonely process of just sitting at your desk typing away, not knowing if there's a world outside.
Yeah, and one of the things, because I think we would have noted since we've been here, since its inception, is that it's grown. It's really become a much more... a bigger festival, just sheer numbers. Do you find it unwieldy? I know that you travel, you go to other festivals. Do Do you find it too big at the moment, or is it finding a sweet spot?
It's not too big. I mean, of course, the problem is that sometimes you want to go to two different things around the same time, so you have to make a choice, but that's like that in all good festivals, I think.
Right. You're an author yourself, or you're a well-known actor.
I think I'm a writer, because I'm not published. I think that would be a writer.
Is that how the transition makes? Sure. Okay. Yeah, so you're a writer.
I'm published.
You're a published author. Published. You're a writer. Let's get this right. Okay. What value for you coming to such a festival?
Well, I think usually I'm wearing my theatre hat, right? So I'm in a director's mode, I'm in an actor mode, but I do like to write and I want to write more. So I think coming to a festival like this, especially after spending a year really immersed in theatre, just helps me reset my brain, get my writer hat back on again, and engage in conversations that writers have. And I love the art of writing. I love listening to writers. I like writing, so helps me to reset my frames, I think.
Okay, so those very personal views. Cam, when you were looking at this year's lineup, there's a lot of talk about human rights, the individuals also working in the queer dimension of issues around literature and such. Are those themes important for you, or do you just want to be part of the social kind of dynamic that a festival like this brings?
Malaysia is a many and varied place, and the kind of themes you were just talking about are progressively coming more to the fore, not just in society, but in culture and in film and in writing. And it's becoming very much part of the conversation. So yeah, it's an opportunity for me to soak that in. It's not something that I have to say is foremost in my work and in my worldview, so I'd like to be informed.
So you're just at the buffet and you're thinking, what a spread it is. Joe, I mean, are the themes important, and what are you focused this year?
Well, I think themes are very important to me. It's about gender. So I think, and of course, gender is a very important issue right now, especially post-election, interestingly enough, has become an even bigger gender on the agenda. So I think for me, it's not being a tourist. You can, or on social media, you can read all these things on social media, you can see how people are interacting, but here's meeting people who are themselves at the forefront of some of these discussions, being there in a room with people making these conversations. So people like Regina Ibrahim, for example, listening to her today, talking about the books that she's been writing and why she's been writing. I think those things are very important for the national conversation. So I think it's good to be part of the national conversation on a literary level.
You know, because it's said that events like this are very elitist, they reach out to a small number of people, and they represent a very kind of a particular segment of society that's interested in these things. I mean, do you think that criticism is valid, Cam?
The criticism is based on a truth. That, yes, that is undeniably the case. But that doesn't then mean that it's not a legitimate community and a legitimate concerns. Every community has its own particular concerns, right? And every community should have the conversations that they need to have. Mm-hmm. So if, let's say, it's very much an urban, an urban conversation, you said elite, I mean, you could say a middle class. I don't think it is limited to that. But if there are conversations that are in them, well, there's nothing wrong with it. We all deserve to be able to have our conversations and to learn from other people. I mean, I was very excited just walking in just now. You said about how it started very small, this festival many years ago. I mean, there are student groups here. There are people who have literally come from around the world. I met a fellow who'd come in from New Zealand specifically for this. People who've come up from KL, people from Penang. And so, yes, you say it's an elitist thing, but if it is an elitist thing, then, well, it's a sizable group.
Okay, so it's elitist, maybe, but it's okay because it's a part of the Malaysian reality.
I think that's the term you've given to it, which is a pejorative term, but I would say let's look at it as, I don't know, urban middle class.
But I think also maybe it's not so much elitist or even small. It's actually really large. It's as Cam says, usually all these people are at home alone writing. Their books then go out to a huge number of people. So actually their reach is massive. Their reach is maybe not as massive as TV or film, but definitely big. And you know, we want to, perhaps people want to think that there should be even a larger reading culture in Malaysia. So it's actually a large reach that, and we are seeing the epicenter of that, or gathering of those people, whose thoughts then go out into a much larger field. So I think that's important. And yeah. It's a time for those people to get together and have conversations with themselves, which will then inspire their work, and that will have a larger reach elsewhere.
I know we're kind of in the post-literate world now, but, you know, and books are residual, they're seen as a minority concern. I am myself love books. But the question is, again, and always asked to justify this, I mean, are books really valuable to society, Cam?
I hope so, because I write them. And it would be really annoying if it's not the case. No, they are. Actually, if you look at sales, for instance, I couldn't give you the figures, but sales, books around the world, especially non-fiction books, are going up. Maybe the sales of new fiction books are not doing that great, but the sales of old classic fiction is on the rise. There was a case where a while back we thought e-books would be the future, but actually, as people's e-books are breaking down.
Oh, are they?
Yeah, they're literally breaking. You can't really fix them. So the sales of books are going up. So whether or not people actually read the books that they buy, I'm not sure, but books are still a thing. And
Joe, you grew up surrounded by books and a family that's quite literary. Your dad was also an author because he's published.
Yes.
And I recently bought a copy of your dad's book, or one of his many books. How important is passing on that love of books, do you think, especially to younger people?
Yeah, I think it's hugely important. And I think young people are very receptive to books, to words, right? So, because it's all about articulating something. So children want to mimic, want to find. So if you present it as something wonderful and exciting and opens a door to a very rich and varied world, of course, if you present it in those terms, who couldn't be interested? Often I think it's presented as sort of like a closed book, here it is, and open it because you have to, as opposed to you won't believe what's inside this. It'll take you out of yourself, it'll take you out of your country. And I think this is why things like this are so important, because it doesn't take us just to Penang. Like going to Penang to a festival like this, you go all over the world, and that's great.
I mean, this is a particularly cosmopolitan reach in this, you know, and I'm going to be speaking later to an Italian who lives in India, an Indian who works on Dalit poetry, who's doing a PhD in Singapore. It is really traveling around the world. One thing we don't have this year is controversy. In the previous iterations of the festival, we've had a bit of controversy. I remember Zuna had his, his exhibit either stopped or raided or threatened. Do you think controversy is good for a festival like this?
Well, there's a minor controversy, just to say that so here we are in Penang, it's the Georgetown Literary Festival. So there is a feeling amongst Penang people that Penang people don't really necessarily have much of an ownership on this. All sides have been trying to reach out to each other to bring that together. So, you know, there's a bit of controversy there.
Okay, so there's this a perennial problem of the location or something, and to what extent. I don't know if you agree, there's a bit of parochialism in that, I think, controversy, because it's not this year only, but it's been a kind of reoccurring gripe that some local writers are feeling excluded and such. Okay, so beyond that, Joe, there's going to be a couple more days after the festival. Once the circus has moved on, what's left? For somebody like you, I mean, do you look back? Do you keep contact with people that you meet here?
I mean, it's been nice to come and meet people who I haven't seen for a few years, and that's the festival's also an opportunity to meet people who I only meet at these sorts of things. I just met up with somebody who I haven't seen for years, and we'll catch up during this festival, and it's a way of reconnecting with writer friends who live elsewhere, and I think that's very useful always.
Right. And Cam, for you, what happens when the circus moves on?
I cry a little. I sing songs. No, I think
tears down your ruddy cheeks.
Yes. I think also, it's an exciting moment. It's fun and everything. But I think perhaps the question also is what about Georgetown? What about Penang? I mean, you know, they've invested a lot in this. And what happens once the circuit moves on? And I think looking at the crowds here right now, how they've grown and the new kinds of faces that keep coming, young people. From Penang and not from Penang, have come from far away. What it leaves behind is a sense that Georgetown, also tied together with the Georgetown Festival, is a place of excitement and culture, and trying to move boundaries as much as possible. So when the circus leaves town, I think the atmosphere and the air of that discovery, that's what remains.
And I think, you know, for myself, whenever I come to one of these festivals in Georgetown, I always think, oh, next time, I really want to go to Penang, because Penang leaves me with a happy feeling. So it makes you want to think of Penang as a good place.
Sure.
A happy place.
A happy place. Thank you so much for being with me. Coming up next, Carlos Pizzati, an Italian journalist in India. This is Let's Talk. Welcome back to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutan. I'm at the Georgetown Literary Festival in Penang. My guest now, Carlos Pizzati, an Italian journalist in India. And he's got a book called Mapile, an Italian son-in-law in India. And that's what we're going to be talking about. Carlo, you're a European who lives in India. What kind of stories and conversations are you bringing to Georgetown this year?
Well, I'm going to talk about nation and nationhood. I come from a nation which is relatively young because it started in 1866. So we are also a very young Republican nation in Italy. So, and now we have in the government a very powerful man who was interested in creating another nation within Italy, the Northern League, and now is instead battling for Italians above everyone else. So like with a racist agenda. So I'm bringing that conversation. And then point of view of an Italian or European who lives in India and who's kind of like having to face this caste system and not accept it, but at least live with it.
Right, you have a sort of novel you call Mapile, an Italian son-in-law in India. Tell us about that.
Well, Mapile is actually a memoir. I call it a memovel because it's a memoir and a novel. It's a journal of a stupid white man in a brown country. It's kind of a serious book in funny clothes, and it's a book that doesn't attempt to explain India, which is like the expected thing from a whitey that arrives in India and after 2 years writes immediately like about the meaning of life in India and all that. Of course, I don't understand about the meaning of life nor about India because I think it's very difficult to understand. I just talk about what's been happening to me in India in the last 10 years, learning how to bribe traffic police, learning how to bribe the villagers who want a little money for building the temple, but actually loving being there, of course, learning a very important virtue, which I didn't think I needed in India, but actually it grew on me, which is patience. Because in order to survive bureaucracy in India, you become kind of a Vedantic mind, whether you like it or not.
Right, you're both a writer of fiction, but also a journalist, and you write for the Italian paper La Stampa, you write for the long-form essay magazine from India, Scroll, I believe, and you covered wars and stuff. I mean, where's that connection between the journalism and the kind of more imaginative work that you do?
Well, that's an excellent question, because in 2005, after a very long journalistic career, I did TV also in Italy, had a talk show and a bit radio I did, I decided that I would try to do what I really wanted to do, which was to write fiction. So I stopped for a year and a half. I holed up in a cabin outside of Rome, outside of the city, and I washed away the journalistic writing from my hands to rediscover what my voice really was, my fictional voice. And then I came back somehow and discovered that I was going to tell the story of my life as fiction somehow, which helps a lot, because then if you are experiencing your life as fiction, then your fiction takes on life. You know, bizarrely enough, it does work. So I decided to join the two. So I think as a journalist, I'm obviously follow the reliability of facts, and what I report is reliable, and you can trust it. As an essayist, I put my opinion in what conclusions I draw from those facts. As a memoirist and as a novelist, I try to see where the bridges between imagination and your life experience are crossed.
Now, you have written, I believe, about Malaysia and the recent political transformation they've had. Was it an interesting story for you, what happened to Malaysia?
Very fascinating. I think, in general, covering Asia, which is what I cover for La Stampa, is the best beat to have in the media right now. Because if you are covering Europe, it's a bit of a grim tale that you have to tell of a decadence. If you're covering America, it's interesting, but in a sort of scary sort of way. And whereas what's happening in Asia, and we'll talk about Indonesia, India, and Japan is very interesting. I just came back from Korea. I covered the Me Too movement there. It's going through fantastic transformations. And you're covering something that is changing most likely for the best. So about Malaysia, I think it's very, very fascinating, because it seems like there has been a democratic process emotions. This is what's happening. Talking to my editor-in-chief also of La Stampa, we're saying, like, the so-called third world is becoming first, while the so-called first world is sliding towards becoming third. So this is the interesting thing, is the process of democratizations. I mean, I wrote about your young sports minister, which is very interesting for Italians. We are now having younger politicians come over on the scenes. We used to have older politicians, like your current leader of your country. That was very normal in Italy, but we're having a change of generation now. It's our deputy prime minister very young, in their 40s, basically. So I think it's interesting to draw connections also by an international trend that is happening in Malaysia, even though you have an older leader, but you have also opening access to younger politicians.
Right. I mean, I guess Malaysia and Indonesia are seen as countries that are bucking the trend when it comes to the story of democracy globally. You know, actually moving in a progressive fashion, whereas with much of Europe, democracy is the basis on which populism and this anti-globalization or xenophobia is built.
Absolutely.
How? What are the prospects for Italy in the foreseeable future? At least in the terms that, you know, we've been talking about, populism and
stuff. Yeah, well, they're not very good at the moment. What happened is, right after the elections in March, the Northern League, which is a rather anti-immigrant platform, and the Five Star Movement, which is a strong anti-immigrant platform, joined forces, 32% plus 17%. The Deputy Prime Minister, Salvini, has been blocking ships from coming from Africa into Italy and diverting them into Spain, and has been using a very strong rhetoric against immigration, whereas we know that immigrants have no impact on criminality or worsening the economy, quite the contrary, in real fact, of course. But it actually paid off because the popularity of the government with this line has gone up to 60%. So that's making us worry, those who believe in a unified Europe, because one of the main programs, one of the main topics of the programs of this coalition of government is to eventually leave the euro and Europe. So I think there is a reason to worry right now. I don't know if it will happen, but there is definitely a reason to worry about whether Italy is intending to stay in Europe or not in the next 5 years.
Okay, I'm going to squeeze one last question out of you, which is because the question of Indian politics, you said you've been there the last 10 years, the rise of Narendra Modi, BJP, Hindutva as a campaign, and all that we see, you know, the cow protection leagues and the murders that have happened.
Yep.
What's your take on the Indian conversation?
Well, the Indian conversation is even more fascinating and full of contradictions, of course, because on the one hand, you do have the RSS, the Shiv Sena, the Hindu fundamentalists have been given more room than they should have. The government has not voiced its protests quickly enough. It did a bit too late, I think. And so it'll be interesting in the next elections in 2019 to see how they will react, if there will be more episodes like this. On the other hand, you've had also journalists being killed, you know, intellectuals being called secularists and then being killed very easily. So I think there should be a change of legislation to make these kind of murders tried much faster. And this would be a very good sign, for example.
There's a lot of impunity, you think, in India?
I don't know if there is impunity. There is a complicated system of justice, which we have in Italy also, so there is slow trials. But again, we have to look at another side of what's been happening in India. Think about 2019, the famous rape in Delhi, and how, you know, that horrible event changed the justice system, because the people went to the street and demanded for faster trials, and there was an improvement. So we have to look at the fact that the Me Too movement in Italy is in India. Sorry about this lapsus, because I'm Italian and Indian, I suppose. But in India is making more progress than in Italy, for example. I think that they should make more progress, of course. But they were able to really point out major culprits of sexual harassment. So we have to remember that there is progress in India, even though it's cohabitating with Hindu fundamentalists at the head of the government. On the other hand, I think that the other movements towards a more progressive India are still ongoing. So it's cohabitating as usual with the many contradictions that make India beautiful and an enjoyable place to live in.
Okay, thank you so much, Carlo.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Let's Talk with me, Shira Twitter. And I'm at Penang's Georgetown Literary Festival. My next guest is Gopika Jadeja. She is a poet and translator working in English and Gujarati. Gopika, you're a poet and a translator working in English and Gujarati, but also doing a PhD thesis working on the Dalit movement in your native Gujarat. Gujarat, of course, being the home state of Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India. How did those things come together, the translation, the poetry, and Dalits?
So my thesis actually started off as a translation project. And it started off with my reading of Gujarati poetry. And as I read more Gujarati poetry, I realized that there were voices that were missing. And one of the voices that I found missing was that of Dalits.
Right. And missing because do Dalits have just an oral tradition, or do they, as a community, in fact, you need to help me understand what a Dalit is. Is that a community? Is it just your position in the caste system?
Mm-hmm. So let's start with what Dalit means. So Dalit is a self-claimed marker of identity for communities which were formerly called untouchable. So pre-independence and even post-independence in India, there were various names that these communities must have been called in different parts of the country. But for most part, those names were names given by upper caste communities to these communities that were outside the caste system. And what that meant was these were pejorative many instances.
Right.
And which is why Dalit then becomes a self-claimed marker which gives them self-respect.
Right. Is this something that emerges post-independence? I know that that Gandhi had mentioned the question of untouchability, and he's a controversial figure, kind of sounding like he accepts it, but also got critical of it. And then there are all these other figures that in Indian politics are around this spot. Is Dalit a modern phenomena then?
Well, I would say that if you're looking at the pre-independence period, there's Gandhi, but an even more important figure is Dr. Ambedkar,
right?
B.R. Ambedkar. And he has, before independence, he's already started advocating for rights, for equality, for the communities. And then when he is part of the drafting committee of the Indian Constitution, he's able to bring those ideas of equality into the Indian Constitution. So we have Ambedkar to thank for the principles of equality that are enshrined in the Constitution, and which also, in some ways, empower Dalits in India.
Right. And today, you know, with Narendra Modi in power, with the BJP, with the RSS, and the Hindutva movement, where do Dalits stand in this? You know, are they seen as Hindu, or are they not Hindu?
So, there are various aspects to this. I would say that Dalits today and parties that espouse the Dalit cause today, like the BSP, are resisting the Hindutva narrative of Narendra Modi and his government. So in that sense, there is a narrative of resistance that's coming from Dalits around the country. In Gujarat in particular, over the past couple of years, there has been a huge movement. And this movement started off with an atrocity, with an act of atrocity in a village in the Una district. Four Dalit youth were mercilessly beaten up by other youth who were associated with a Hindu nationalist organization. And they were mercilessly beaten up because they were skinning dead cows. Now, that is an occupation that is a hereditary occupation for some Dalit communities.
Right. So,
what is important here is the symbolism of the cow, because the cow becomes very important for the Hindu right wing, and that is how, you know, the Dalits are caught in between here, you know, as communities that have been tasked with doing these jobs. And then the NTB flaws of this government, or the NTB flaws that were already in place but, you know, have been put into motion, you know, by this government.
Right.
So, you know,
we hear a lot about the cow protection leagues.
Absolutely.
They go, they attack people, and they're Muslims mostly, but also Dalits.
So
we have the politics, and people, Dalits, I assume, gravitate to political parties as a form of expression. But what about poetry? So where is the cultural expression of this resistance to the Hindu nationalist narrative?
So after the incident that I spoke about, there was a march that was led by a few Dalit leaders. And the march ended in a huge meeting in the village of Mota Samajala, where this incident took place. And one of the things that happened there was on the stage, you know, people spoke, but one young Dalit poet called Jayesh Solanki recited a poem. And that particular poem was written many years ago by a poet called Sahil Parmar. And the Gujarati is difficult to render, but basically what the poem says is, "We will not drag your dead cattle away." And each time the poet repeated that line, "We will not drag your dead cattle away," the audience repeated it with him.
Oh,
it's a very, very powerful expression of resistance there.
Okay, I come from a generation perhaps more influenced by television, read the novel perhaps. Poetry seems like a form that is residual, part of the past, it's fading away. But that's my experience. In India, is poetry still a powerful expression, form of expression?
I would say poetry anywhere would remain a powerful form of expression because it is related to speech, it's related to orality. And there is that kind of oral power to poetry, which lends itself to movements of protest. And in Gujarat especially, since the late 70s, when the Dalit social and political and also the literary movement started in Gujarat, poetry has been a predominant form of expression. And it was the poets who first joined hands with the activists, especially say in the 80s when there were anti-reservation movements. Now, reservations are again another feature that Ambedkar had woven in into the constitution, which meant basically that Dalits would be, or constitutionally called scheduled castes, and then you have the scheduled tribes, would be positively discriminated against,
right, so
in educational institutions, in government jobs. And there was a huge backlash against this in the 80s because other measures were introduced. So during this time, it was the young Dalit poets and activists in Gujarat who resisted the other young activists who were anti-reservation.
Okay, so Dalits, Dalits, I imagine, would be working in whatever local languages they are. I mean, across India, Dalits speak all kinds of languages, I imagine. Is Gujarati itself a language that has hierarchy, that, you know, that, or is it a language that's open to all? Does it, you know, work in various registers?
Let's talk about pronouns. In Gujarati, you have, like in Hindi, you have three pronouns. You have aap, which is the highest register. You have tame, which is the middle register. If we are speaking, I would probably, and if we don't know each other very well, I'd probably call you tame. And then there's tu, which is the lowest register, which is how you might address a child or someone lower in the social hierarchy. And supposing an upper caste person is speaking to a Dalit, they would address the Dalit as tu and not as tame. So in some sense, hierarchy, that kind of hierarchy is built into the language, which is why many Dalit poets and many Dalit writers in Gujarat think that English is a better language of expression for them. And one of these poets is Nirav Patel, and he has written this essay, which is called Gujarati, My Mother Tongue, English, My Foster Mother.
Oh, okay, that's fascinating. So English, a legacy of colonialism, returns as a language of protest or resistance.
Or emancipation, rather
emancipation.
And here emancipation is, in some sense, economic as well. Because we must remember that in, the caste system, as much as it is social, is also economic. It's a division of labor. And it's an unequal division of labor.
So are you surprised as a researcher, somebody doing actually looking at the dynamics of poetry, Dalit resistance and such, that English emerged as this mediator for protests and resistance?
It is a little surprising. And it meant this preference for English manifests itself in different ways in different parts of the country. There is actually now a temple to the goddess English.
You're kidding me.
There is literally
English is a goddess, not a male deity.
Not a male deity. She's a female deity, and there's a statue to her. And I think one of the aspects of the statue is a computer.
Right.
So it becomes an icon, right? It becomes a symbol for emancipation that is going to come through education, which is going to lead to a better life. You know, so it is, in some sense, it is economic independence and economic emancipation that these communities are also seeking, and which they hope is going to lead them, you know, to a better class status and then to a better social status and more acceptance.
Last question for you. Coming to Malaysia, where there are, of course, people of South Asian descent, I'm clearly of South Asian descent. Is there something in the Malaysian story that you're interested in, considering the kind of work that you do?
I think I would be interested in, particularly in the way Indianness is viewed in Malaysia. So there are various Indian communities that came to Malaysia, and you have a historical migration. And what I would really be interested in is exploring that migration and exploring what it means to be Indian or of Indian origin in Malaysia, and how does that add to the Malaysian fabric? What does it then mean to be Malaysian and Indian?
Fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And that's all we have for you today. Just a small sample of the over 100 participants from 25 countries at the Georgetown Literary Festival. We're going to be bringing you more, so stay tuned to Let's Talk with Mishra Atkutin, only on Astro 1E.